This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Packer grew up in a liberal family in an age of liberal decline. He's heard the word liberal used as a political weapon not only by the right, but by the left, which particularly in the late 60s and early 70s saw liberalism as too status quo. Packer's father was a law professor and administrator at Stanford University in the late 60s, and his brand of liberalism was under attack during the student protests. George Packer's grandfather was a liberal who represented Birmingham in the U.S. Congress from 1915 to 1937. In the new memoir, Blood of the Liberals, George Packer reflects on his political upbringing and the political changes that he, his father, and grandfather underwent. Packer is a journalist and novelist. Let's start with a reading from his new memoir.
In early 1969, my father suffered a stroke that paralyzed his right side and left him a cripple who had difficulty speaking whole sentences. He was 43 and about to leave his position as an academic administrator at Stanford to return to the rational world of teaching law. Throughout 1968, he'd been battling sit-ins and firebombings at the university while the country was torn apart by riots, assassinations, and the endless war in Vietnam. After these upheavals, the year ended with the election of Richard Nixon, the politician my father had hated all his life. At the time of his stroke, I was 8 years old. I didn't know why my father got sick. I knew still less why students shouted at him on the campus radio, why the Democratic Convention in Chicago turned into a pitched battle as we watched on television, why the word assassination put such a spell on me. But I understood with a child's clarity that the world, which not long before had been a delightful place of caterpillars and basketball, was suddenly full of danger, that the adults had lost control and were helpless to protect me. Even then I sensed my father's fragility, not just in his body but in his manner of thinking and living, that his commitment to the life of reason stood no chance against the world going mad.
And that's George Packer reading from his new memoir, Blood of the Liberals. George, your father was vice provost for academic planning at Stanford. He got that position in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
He also served on the Academic Council's Executive Committee, which also put him on the front lines in the confrontations with students. Your father was under attack from the left and the right as an academic administrator. He was under attack from the students on the left. Who was attacking him on the right?
The alumni were attacking him on the right. It went back to his hiring at Stanford in 1956. He was hired by the law school in 56, and immediately Herbert Hoover, who was a trustee of the university and really sort of the waning power behind the scenes, tried to block his appointment because his appointment had coincided with a grant from the Fund for the Republic, which was a civil liberties arm of the Ford Foundation, to study the testimony of Whitaker Chambers and other ex-communists. So his appointment became mixed up with sort of the twilight of the McCarthy era, and he was red-baited, and his appointment was nearly canceled, but in the end, the university came through. So 10 years later, when he was appointed vice provost, the ghosts of the McCarthy era came back sort of in the last gasps of conservatism at that time, and a conservative alumni group said that he would be leading students to revolt against the university, which proved deeply ironic since, in fact, those same students were attacking the appointment from the other side. And far from leading them to revolt, my father became something of a hardliner in opposing sit-ins and other student actions.
And the student body president during this period was David Harris, who became famous for being a draft resister and for marrying Joan Baez.
That's right. And he and my father tangled almost as soon as my father was appointed vice provost over a very minor-seeming issue. But in those days, every minor issue was instantly polarized and became a crisis. In this case, it was the appointment of students to a committee that my father chaired. It was a committee that was intended to reform undergraduate education. My father's idea was the research university had lost its way and had begun to ignore both undergraduate education and basic questions of value and humanistic scholarship, and he wanted to reorient it toward students and toward value questions. So this committee was intended to make Stanford, in a way, a more student-friendly place. But David Harris saw simply the administration trying to strong-arm students to bend to its will. So it became a power struggle between them. It also became a struggle over the question of whether It's possible to be disinterested, to be an intellectual with an independent mind that does not simply reflect your status and your power. My father staked his life on a belief that that was possible, but David Harris and the students were suspicious of those claims. They thought any claim to being independent was just a cover for university power.
What kind of decisions did your father have to make in the confrontations with students? Like, was he involved with deciding whether to call the police onto the campus or not, which is one of the big questions that university administrators had to deal with?
Right. Well, the climactic event of his career was a student sit-in in May of 1968 that followed the Columbia takeover by just a week. And the example of Columbia was vivid in everyone's mind of the cops coming in and using batons to clear out buildings and horses stampeding up Broadway. So no one in the administration wanted to call in the police. My father's position, in a way, was a legalistic one. His position was that the students were using coercion to try to change university policy on student discipline, basically. And he thought it was illegitimate, that the only legitimate means of persuasion in an intellectual institution was rational debate. And so because of that belief, he became quite polarized from the students, quite hostile to the takeover, and really unwilling to negotiate with them. But as it turned out, he was not in the power position. Because the administration and the students were so hostile to each other, the faculty had to step into the breach to resolve it. And what the faculty did was essentially to give in to the student demands, which my father thought was a disaster. And he actually drafted a resignation letter, but he decided not to resign. Instead, he became a very vocal and pointed, barbed speaker against both the student and the faculty. And for a period, he was quite an isolated figure on campus.
And then your father had a stroke and he had to stop teaching altogether. It strikes me as a really thankless time to have been a university administrator. Was your father sorry that he had left teaching and become an administrator?
I think so. His pride might have kept him from admitting that he was not up to the job, that the job defeated him. But if you read between the lines of some of his letters, you see that there's a lot of regret and anger, really anger, at all sides, at the students, at the faculty, at the administration, the trustees. He was sort of embattled on all fronts in his years as an administrator. And in a way, he wasn't cut out to be an administrator. He didn't understand consensus. He saw Stanford as an institution of intellectual freedom rather than as a community that needed to have all its members getting along. He was really ready to do battle on issues of principle rather than to assuage feelings. So I don't think he was a good administrator. I think it was a mistake for him to take it. And at one point after his stroke, he wrote a letter to a friend saying, in 1966, I was stupid enough to become an administrator. I've since suffered a stroke, whether as punishment or just consequence, I don't know. So in the irony of that, you can hear his bitterness at those years.
Now, you were very young when your father was an administrator at Stanford.
Yeah,
you were
just a kid.
About eight during the period that we're talking about. And you write in your book that you felt the adults had lost control. What are some of your memories of the student protests?
In a way, I was sort of out of it. I was far more interested in the presidential campaign of 1968. So my memories of student protest were quite sketchy in the years when my father was on the front lines. After his stroke, I think that put my own family and our community onto my psychic map in a way they hadn't been before. I had to focus on the world immediately around me and get out of this sort of abstract interest in politics. And then I was frightened. I felt that we were sort of under siege. We had security floodlights installed. We had a hotline to the police. There were phone calls that were unpleasant. There was the campus radio broadcasting speeches in which my father and others were spoken of with a lot of contempt and hostility. I think basically fear and worry about my parents, worry that they weren't up to it and were going to be overwhelmed by all this passion.
My guest is George Packer. His new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. George Packer is my guest, and his new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. Your grandfather was a congressman from Alabama serving in the U.S. Congress from 1915 to 1937.
Right, my mother's father.
Yeah, and he thought of himself as a liberal. What did liberal mean to your grandfather?
To him, it meant that he was on the side of the common people, or what he called the plain people, against concentrations of power. And it really went back to Jefferson and to the idea that for America to be a republic of free and equal people, no group could gain too much power over any other group, political or economic. We needed everyone, in Jefferson's view, to have 50 acres and a public education in order to remain a democracy. And my grandfather tried to carry that idea into the 20th century. He was born in the middle of the 19th century, just after the Civil War, and his career, he lived a very long time until 1960. His career essentially covered the years of reform in the populist, progressive, and New Deal era. But he was unable to translate Jeffersonian ideas into the 20th century, because when finally the New Deal seemed to enact the political principles that my grandfather had been living by, that is to say, fighting on behalf of poorer people, using government to create justice and equality, he took a look at the New Deal and he hated it. It didn't look anything like Jeffersonian democracy. In fact, it looked to him more like corporate control, except now the control was in the hands of government bureaucrats instead of Wall Street bankers. In a sense, he was an old-fashioned populist, which made him a liberal until the New Deal, and then it made him a conservative. He claimed he didn't change at all. It was the definitions of the words that changed. But in his last debate in Congress, an opponent said to him, "It's pathetic that the liberal hero of my youth is going to go down to defeat as the conservative gentleman from Birmingham, Alabama." And in fact, he was defeated, and that was the end of his career.
What are some of the beliefs that you were brought up on that you identified with liberalism?
Basically, it came down to sympathy with the black and the poor. The idea that middle-class people had an obligation to help the disadvantaged. And race was really prominent in my childish consciousness, largely because of my mother, who grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and brought to California a strong Southern consciousness of race guilt and race obligation. So I had this burden placed on me pretty young that nothing was free. I wasn't to go through life simply racking up my own achievements, that I had an obligation to be concerned about the poor and the black. Now, how this translated into policy is another matter, and in some ways it did so rather ineffectively. The emotions were quite strong, but the policies, I think, were vulnerable, and I only began to question them once I left home and grew up and saw something of the world.
Which policies did you question? What did you question about them?
I began to question everything. I mean, I still call myself a liberal, but on the other hand, the liberal positions on things like welfare and taxes and crime and patriotism and affirmative action were really open to attack, because they were positions held by people who didn't seem to have to give up anything. They were entitled positions that were asking sacrifices of other people who had more to give up. An issue like busing, for example. There's a moment in my book which is kind of painful for me to recall, because I don't think it was fun for my mother to recall it, but when I was about 13 or 14, the Boston busing crisis was in full swing, and I knew that the family were in favor of busing, but I was troubled, and I asked her, well, would you allow me to be bused? And she admitted, I think quite honestly, that she wouldn't, but she also said that education meant more to our family, and that struck me at the time as a hard thing to swallow, and I think it might have struck her in the same way once she said it. It was an honest moment, and probably she was speaking for a lot of liberals at the time who were for busing in the abstract, but maybe not in their own neighborhood. And that made liberals extremely vulnerable to the charge of hypocrisy and of being out of touch with the world and of making decisions for people that that they themselves didn't have to live by. And I think that picture of the liberal consigned a whole series of Democratic candidates to defeat.
Now, you went to the Peace Corps, I guess, when you got out of college, and
yes,
taught English in Togo. Now, we had discussed this on Fresh Air years ago, but tell us again. You went there with all these, like, liberal ideals and beliefs, and you came home early. Why?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not quite as simple as I was disillusioned by the world and found I couldn't put my liberal beliefs into practice, because actually I didn't go quite as naive as that. I basically wanted an adventure. I wanted to find out who I was, and the old path of the military didn't appeal to me, but the Peace Corps seemed to offer the same test. And I guess I failed it in the sense that I went home early. It was really more of an existential crisis and something of a psychological crisis. I lost faith in myself and in the way I'd been raised and in who I was. Something about being alone in a little village in West Africa for weeks on end undermined me, and I came home early, really, in order to save my life. I'm not sure I would have survived. My father's suicide was haunting me when I was in Africa. I thought about it all the time, and I think it was a good thing that I got out of there, although I left with an acute sense of failure and really carried that with me for years, and that influenced the direction I took when I got back to the United States.
Your father committed suicide 3 years after his stroke. Why was it in Africa that you started thinking about it so much?
Because I was left alone for such long periods of time that it was inevitable to be in a little cement room in the middle of the day when absolutely nothing is stirring except a rooster, in the heat, without a telephone, without electricity, without a television. There were no distractions. And without distractions, I suddenly found myself face to face with the past and with my father. And I had this strange sense that I was going to live out his fate. And in fact, one night, I became convinced that I was about to have a stroke and die, just as, you know, as he had a stroke in this remote part of Africa. And I had a local driver rush me to the hospital where a German doctor assured me that I was fine.
What was the problem?
Beginning nervous breakdown was his diagnosis.
Is that part of what sent you home?
Yeah, it wasn't at that moment, but that was that was the kind of thing that sent me home. Too many beginning nervous breakdowns and you actually have a nervous breakdown.
Your book is called Blood of the Liberals, and it's mostly a memoir, not only about your life, but about your grandfather's life and your father's life and their political and intellectual beliefs. Do you feel like you have inherited something of their liberal beliefs? And why did you call it Blood of the Liberals?
I have inherited something, which I have to then make my own. It's called Blood of the Liberals because, first of all, the word liberals is used deliberately. As I said, I don't want to run away from that word. I think it's a worthy word and needs rehabilitation. Blood because, first of all, it is about bloodlines. It's about inheritance and legacy and how each generation has to grapple with the beliefs and the experiences of the last generation, but then has to grapple also with its own times. And there's a line in the book where I say the story of my family is the story of an inherited idea crashing up against the hard rock of new circumstance. So with each generation, the inherited idea, which broadly is liberalism, had to contend with new forces and new historical circumstances and had to be remade, had to change its shape. And I think in both the case of my grandfather and my father, they weren't able to make it. change in a way that they could use. In other words, they clung to an idea that outlived its viability, and they both paid a price for it.
Well, George Packer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
George Packer's new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.